Hello everyone, welcome back to The Left Page. I am Frank, your always online historian, academic, and writer. I am joined, as always, by my great friend and political scientist, Leon. Hello, Leon.
Politics. Politics everywhere.
Oh, that always the mood, I feel. Always the mood.
Reaction.
Reaction everywhere.
Reaction everywhere. Sorry, go on.
Still, again, sadly still true. That is more sad. Yeah. Today we have a very special episode because it is a listener and a Patreon's recommendation for us to read and talk about. So thank you very much, Reckoner or Nate, as you might know him. It was a great and very interesting recommendation.
Definitely.
Yes. You know this already, Nate in particular, speaking to you, that there's a lot to talk about and a lot of complex, not that great stuff either, but it was still a fantastic read, and it hit the specific notes of the stuff that I do. So here's what it is, everyone. It is The Actual Star by Monica Byrne, a utopian novel, sci-fi novel. It's a lot more than that, and quite elaborate and dense. So what is this book? I am not going to give a general narrative, like play-by-play, or just like, oh, here's where it goes or whatnot. Mostly what I want to do in terms of the plot is like, okay, here are the timelines or the time spots and the questions, and bring up the plot relevance as it becomes, again, you know, relevant. Because this is a book with three different time moments, because the point is that they are a single timeline. We have 3012, 2012, and 1012. So what are the through lines, the circumstances at each one? We have in 1012 this failing Mayan royal family and kingdom, so to speak, which is suffering from droughts and not necessarily wars, but just things not working out in that front, and how the soon-to-be coronated rulers handle the situation. In 2012, we have this, you know, contemporary reality that deals a bit with kind of a self-discovery and connecting with the main character of that period, their Mayan roots in Belize, and how they do that, and, you know, the whole Mayan calendar thing in 2012, and dealing a bit with that, and Torres, and all that. And in 3012 is, you know, where the descriptor of the book comes into play, which is this utopian depiction of this society known as La Viaja, or, because that is a whole point, in English, the journey, right? That is, or the voyage, that's literally what it's called in Spanish. And there's a reason for that, and which we will get into. But the book has these three different moments. They are clearly defined, but difficult to parse through. Why are we here, right? Like, why are we talking about this in particular? Or why are we talking about this in particular? And so on. Excusing, you know, the third one, because, you know, being the most advanced in time is the one that has a lot more uncertainty. Because in some sense, we can guess what is happening or what is going to happen in one and two, but not in three.
Great summary.
Thank you. I feel like the way to go about it is that the book parses out in an interesting way sometimes, because they're not always like, oh, they aren't single characters. Like, it's, you have multiple character point of views for each timeline. I think you have like three each.
Yeah.
So it's nine different point of views in three different timelines. And if it's a quite complex to follow, and there is a strong density and vocabulary in the third utopian one.
So I had a unique advantage with that. I bought the book, and I also acquired, don't pay attention to my choice of words, I also acquired the audiobook. So for me, on the audiobook version, it was very clear when we switched around, because there were different narrators.
Right.
So shout out to whoever directed that. that was a very smart choice.
Nice.
That's beside the point. I'm sorry, Frank.
No, that makes sense. And but I think it touches a bit on one thing that we were talking about, how there's a difficulty in parsing, and that'll become clearer as we dive into the utopian dimension of the third one, or lack thereof, which is that the characters' motivations or points aren't entirely... They're more plot points or motifs to be realized than actual characters with, you know, nuance and development. There isn't really Well, if there is development, we are told of it. We are not shown it, or we don't follow it.
Yeah, I don't always like the advice of, oh, show, don't tell, because I think...
Yeah, same.
I don't mind exposition as much as long as you're responsible with it, and as long as people are on the way doing the thing. And a lot of people complain about... Sorry to bring up this book series, but a lot of people complain about the third main saga book of The Witcher, because there are a lot of conversations at a campfire. But by that time, out of five books... the third book is kind of allowed to do that.
Of course.
Because by book three, and I don't know if you're still reading this, if this isn't the case, you probably like those characters.
Yeah.
And if you like those characters, you can... Then I enjoy, like, you know, them philosophizing and complaining about their lives at a campfire.
Yes.
And a lot of people are like, oh, that's character exposition. I'm like, no, that's good writing, actually.
That is.
however, this is a standalone book. They don't have that advantage. So
yeah.
There's not a lot of campfire talk, but there's a lot of... Well, okay, so it's not necessarily exposition, but the way it verbally shines a light on events, I'm like, okay, yeah, this would have been really cool if I could see this, actually.
Yeah.
So, you know, in this case, I'm a bit of a hypocrite. I'm like, you know what? Do show, do not tell. I guess you just have to be responsible with those things, as you do with all single writing techniques.
Yeah, I think the point here is that we are told things more interesting than the things we're shown.
Yes, that's a really good way to put it.
Because, and I like this as a motif. I like it when Kafka does it. I love it when From Software does this, which we are told of a bunch of stuff that happens, but we do not see it happen. We need to parse together what is happening.
Well, now you're talking about like two titans of storytelling, which is a bit unfair.
That's fair.
This is a standard.
I mean, here's the thing, right? I think regardless of whatever criticism we will have of this book is extremely delicately crafted. Like, there is an attention to make things work, to make things fit. Maybe save the ending, but we'll save the ending for the end. Because we have personal and other issues with it. But there's something about, you know, what you show, what you imply, because... Given the three different timelines, we are told of things that will happen to characters in 1012 or in 2012, or that happened to characters between 2012 and later, or things that preceded the Utopian formation. But we aren't always following the more necessarily interesting correlated plot point. Here's the big thing that is happening, and that kind of... If it doesn't carry it, it carried it for me in the future of 3012. The society is at a bit of a crisis because it is set upon two different and connected tendencies, which that it is both founded upon a kind of religious cult or religious following, religious set of beliefs, which, you know, entails a lot of positive, interesting things, right? Like hospitality, fraternity, respect, understanding, liberty, exploration in a kind of positive, independent way. So, like, these are, it sounds a bit bad, founding principles, but they are connected with a religious belief, right? Like, which is one of the main character you follow in 2012. Leia in 3012 is Saint Leia. So, you know, she is this holy figure, really. Like, we're talking not just a political figure, right? Like, if Leon or I refer to Marx as, like, Saint Marx...
Sorry, go on.
We're adding a degree of satire. We're adding a lightness to it, not a gravity to it. It is not the same. It's like, if I'm referring to, like, Saint Peter, then it is different than I'm referring to St. Mark's.
Yeah.
To give a real example.
Also, we would never refer to Marx as a saint.
Oh, no, definitely not. Like, I feel like we would call Marx a saint in kind of the same way Marx himself called Max Stirner Saint Max, which is quite funny and mocking. It's still funny. Anyway, not different conversations, but interesting points to bring, I think. But, you know, that is a really interesting point and something I've never seen before, right? Like, what if a utopia, which, you know, there are a lot of things in terms of respect and sociability and in terms of a level of decision and discussion, which is built on a kind of totally democratic sense, right? Like, it is, the book portrays it, references clearly that, you know, it was influenced by Kim Stanley Robinson, it was influenced by Ursula K. Le Guin, and, you know, those things show up, and I feel like, you know, these collective deciding bodies, which are trying to be as total as possible, is a positive element, right? Like, there are things to this utopia which are undoubtedly great, undoubtedly good, and I feel like those, or at the very least, undoubtedly good, or mostly, for the people in it. Even if, we'll get to that point, some stuff doesn't correlate as well, but we'll get to that.
Oh, yeah.
So this is one of its founding premises, right? Like, it is this religious belief. But this religious belief is connected to what is known as, like, the Cortada, which is never entirely made clear, which is a problem.
No. Yeah, well, it doesn't have to be filled in totally, but it definitely could have stood some more, more descriptive moments about that. Yeah. Especially if you're going to be inspired by Kim Stanley Robinson and fucking Ursula Le Guin.
Yeah.
You know.
But what the Cortada is effectively, and I do not want to, because I know I'm going to butcher it, because it is not my field, and it's been a little bit since I finished the book, because I needed the time to parse things through. but it is connected to the, I think at least, Lipan Maya belief in this, the other world, kind of the underworld, yeah, but not entirely, of Xibalba, which is like a kind of transcendent reality. So the Cortada would be the passing of souls, which in some sense are constantly recurring or reincarnating in people, at least. That's the sense in which the book gives us, to like break this cycle, right? They cross over into Xibalba and are no longer in this recurrence in the real world. So these are told our founding principles of this utopian society. So weird stuff in comparison to the history of utopian narratives, which is great, yeah, really. It's like, yeah, no, be a kind of classic, break stuff. But, and the point that carries the narrative is a character questioning those, well, maybe both of those beliefs, like, right, like, oh, are Cortadas real? Are they something we don't understand yet, right? Instead of like a spiritual transcendent belief, or in what way are we, is this religious tradition positive or not? Like, is this the best way for us to carry our society forward? So effectively a kind of heterodoxy, or maybe even heresy, and the possibility of escalating conflict in utopia. So these are the questions being posed as of yet, right? And we were dissatisfied, a little frustrated with some of the paths the narrative took.
Yeah.
So this is the starter, right? Like, this is kind of what happens to get us to the proper questions and get us in the ways why we don't feel that these were that well resolved. Like, on my part, I feel it was interesting to pose the questions, even if the resolutions weren't as great. But there are other points, right? So let's go with a big one that the book spends a lot of time characterizing, framing, building up, which is that, similar to Marge Percy's Women on the Edge of Time, things in the future are quite distinct. Gender and ethnicity, even, are no longer correlated to a specific, you know, the place you were born, to a specific nationality, a specific territory, or a specific cultural background. It is something you choose, you grow into, you decide to become, or shift from. The writer does not reference Marge Percy, but I have to believe.
Yeah.
I have to believe. because in terms of sexuality, that feels like it came from Kim Stanley Robinson, because he actually is like, what if people were actually transforming and being able to transform their bodies in ways with a lot more freedom and a lot more experimentation, a lot more possibility? It's a discussion that Labour, Kyle and I had for 2312. So go listen to that for the reference point. But again, I like this episode as the necessary third after those two, after Kim Stanley Robinson and Marge Percy, where ethnicity is questioned and framed differently as something you choose, you decide. And honestly, I'm fine. I think it's interesting. It's a little weird. I think it's difficult to break away from our present realities. But Marge Percy prepared me to read through that and not be as frustrated or confused or uncertain as I was when I first read Marge Percy's on it. How did you feel about that, Leon?
Yeah, I definitely agree with the comparison between Marcy and this book. I do think, even though the ending was a bit wonky of that book, I do feel I had at least appreciated that journey a bit more.
Right.
So the way Marcy Percy approaches these source elements that she puts in the book, the Latin American set dressing and so forth and so on, and influences, it felt a lot more functional. It
yes.
felt a lot more like purposely and focused. Here, it's the set dressing is so loud and dense that it kind of swallows up the story.
Yeah,
that is being like, you know, that should be developed, the characters as well. We are supposed to, because you know the introduction of Saint Leah and so on. You're supposed to deeply care about these people. And I, for my part, once again, could be totally me, but for my part, I totally didn't. I was planning, and I ended up doing it, because I don't think it would have been, I don't know, it would be too negative of a vibe, I suppose. But there is a passage in this book in which a young girl does something, and I was going to ask a couple of women, like, hey, what do you think about this? And then they were going to be like, oh, well, that would be clearly written by a man. And then I would have revealed, no, this is a book that's written by a woman. I don't want to get too much into it because, you know, I don't want to judge. Not for me to do. But there were a couple of points and a couple of actions that this character Leah took that I didn't find gross as in, oh, how shocking, because I would be the last person to do that. But I found unbelievable, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm just wrong, and they it's totally justified. Once again, not for me to say, but either I have a shortcoming, or that is that passage was really weirdly written. I'm fine with both possibilities. So you know, so there are a couple of things that don't work for me on a couple of different levels. That's one of them, and then I will stop talking about that, because once again, this is not that kind of podcast. But I did have to point it out, because like there's, I talked about it with you, I believe, as
oh,
well.
Yeah.
Like it was just kind of, like, did we need that? Was that necessary? It's one of those passages that I truly, truly, deeply, profoundly believe that most people would think, oh, only a guy would write this. Because men have read terrible passages about women. But anyway, it's fine. Totally fine to put it in there. It's just, then it doesn't really, but that example, if you have read the book, you know what I'm talking about probably. And if you don't read the book, don't worry about it. The point is that those events, no matter how I feel about that, I can put up with a lot. I am not that person like, oh, you can't put this in a book. That's not how I'm approaching it. But if you were to put a thing in a book, make it matter. Make it like, you know, make it have some like momentum, some like make me feel that this was a conscious and wise decision that you then weave into the broader narrative of the book. That didn't happen. And on that occasion and on multiple other occasions, whereas with Marge Percy, I felt like, okay, I don't wholly agree with introducing this into the book, or rather, it's not my cup of tea. That's a better way to say it. My apologies. But I do feel, I can see where this is going.
Yeah.
I can see how it is a justified addition into the book.
I can see how it configures into the broader narrative. Good job. Whether or not it's my taste doesn't matter, but I can see that there's some craft going on here. I'm not saying this book is incompetently written, far from it. However, I think there should have been some different choices made at different points, and that's one of them.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense, and I think you're pulling at something that I am realizing about this, and I'm going to give an example and start working that idea. So
I'm lifting the scales from your eyes.
Definitely. But one of the things is that we're told this is a single conversation that happens, is that, you know, a character has suffered some kind of future transphobia because...
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah, because while, you know, people were told more generally have both sexual organs, they may identify stronger with one than the other, and they told they suffered for that identification.
Yeah.
And i.e. future transphobia. That's how I'm phrasing it. But that's not a problem per se. The problem is that, okay, what is that accomplishing? Like, why is this here? Is this just a reference to the present? Is this to identify and approach something in this future society? What? But that doesn't
the
go
future
anywhere.
Society that you haven't explained very well?
Well, here, and that's my...
Not you, the writer.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the next point. That's where I was going. I feel like, oddly enough, this book... No, you're fine. This book stands at a place... Which is, well, I'm not going to say it's overcome because I don't think there's such a thing. But going back to something I spoke in the Utopia episode, right? Like previous Utopias or the earlier examples were focused on building a blueprint, presenting it, and, you know, any kind of narrative was kind of not necessarily an afterthought, but it was like a complementing aspect, right? Like it was more about the character having gone there, being convinced, coming back, and telling that story. That's usually that format. What started happening in the late 60s, early 70s, and so on, was a shift from that structure to a much more fluid structure, much more both modern and postmodern narrative, and, you know, breaking apart that specific, lengthier, descriptive, blueprint kind of writing. It's not to say that has died. Because that has been finding a kind of interesting resurgence. There's an idea of the post-critical utopia, which does a bit of both. Recovers that blueprint aspect, that lengthier description, but incorporating or better fusing a narrative into that. The example that the author and the researcher I'm thinking of is considering is Yanis Varoufakis' Another Now. That's the book he's using.
Okay.
But anyway, that's a little beside the point. The thing is, I feel like this book is trying to build that narrative, but missing the point a bit, because ultimately the narrative doesn't do, or like the character work or the following of the story, it doesn't necessarily build the utopian society per se, but it builds the internal universe. It builds the world. And that can be a bit difficult, because what I'm saying is not that it's like it's all in service of making a detailed and convincing utopia, but it is in the service of making this fictional universe consistent or taking the path that it takes. Because to give an example, Saint Leah needs to say or act in a certain way for us to see it or to have it being told that in the future. The three points in time make certain aspects of the narrative predictable.
Sorry, you mentioned Yanis Varoufakis.
Yes.
I just have to say it real quick, I'm so sorry. I really dislike his latest book. Techno-feudalism.
Oh, right, yeah, fair.
What killed capitalism? This is just a personal anecdote, real quick, I'm so sorry, but I have been discouraging people deeply. Like, there have been so many amateurist attempts at political conceptualization of the current state, and they called it like, oh, it's techno-feudalism, it's no longer capitalism, it's techno-feudalism, or like techno-autocrats here, like they've used a bunch of different words, which exactly mean the same thing.
It's like, oh, which is actually all they say with that is, oh my God, tech, explanation mark, question mark. And I'm like, no, it's just capitalism. It's very important that this is just capitalism.
Yeah. No, I agree.
Stop. I'm surprised because this man is supposedly critical of the capitalist mode of system, the current capitalist mode. Didn't do very well as Minister of Finance of Greece.
Yep.
Anyway, don't worry about it. But it's fine. It's whatever. I don't dislike him because I don't agree with him, but I think he speaks very eloquently about a bunch of things and does his research mostly. But with this latest book, he's kind of the leftist Harari for me. really dislike. And I was like, fuck, I hate that so much. Sorry. Anyway, please continue.
No, that's okay. It's an interesting interlude and an important one nevertheless. But
maybe we'll do an episode on it. Who knows? No promises.
No promises.
No promises.
But the point being that the timelines and the sense of recurrence that at the end of the day, we're basically following some of the same characters for in three different spaces of time. When you start picking up on that, it kind of falls off. But before I properly get into that, an example, right, on like the coherence of this universe, but its weakness as a utopian text, I think, is that mostly the utopia is internally convincing, right? Like it has issues, it has like its loose ends, and sometimes they're fine, sometimes they're not, but okay. The point, I think, is that it fails to present itself as an actual alternative, like most, you know, utopian fiction, even if it's aware, because La Viaja, this utopian society, is built after climate catastrophe.
Yeah. How do you feel about that?
I think that's fine. I think that's interesting, right? Like, I'm not... That doesn't bother me either way. Because, like, okay, it is aware of a certain element or a certain grouping of present-day conditions and trying to present, given possible outcomes of that, how an alternative arises. But...
Right. I agree. Okay, sorry. Go on.
Elements of it still fail to convince me. A main one is that effectively, there is no such thing as at least not in a positive light, by largest portions of society, and there's another issue which I'll mention in a bit, that people are no longer sedentary. Effectively, there's just a constant kind of nomadism and traveling and journeying. And I don't know. I'm not entirely sure. And like the explanation is that, oh, it's because climate refugees did that a lot. And, you know, that kind of nomadism is something that we kind of incorporated into our theology, really. To a degree, okay. Yeah. Okay, that is a reasonably convincing explanation. Reasonably, but okay, regardless. No, don't need to be too in-depth. The point is, me, as a reader of this book, in 2024, do not find that as a convincing alternative. I do not... It's like, because if utopian narratives are always engaging in a critique of the present to build their alternative... The alternative here doesn't feel that moored in actual present reality. If I'm making myself reasonably clear.
No, definitely. I definitely don't disagree. I think the thing that we are discovering is that everything could have been so much stronger if the utopian part was more solid and worked out. Because all these things that we encounter lead towards the utopia.
Yes.
And I feel like the whole, for me, the climate change thing, I don't mind it, but it would have been so much stronger if the utopia was broader, because then that reflects onto the choice of the climate change thing. Now, because it isn't as strong as I would like it to be, I don't feel like this is necessarily what the writer did, but she also didn't do anything to prevent me from feeling like this. Which is that I feel like there's a sort of determinist collapse mindset whilst writing this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not accusing her of her that it's definitely the case. It's just it didn't do anything to dissuade me of that either, which you kind of need to do. Yeah. And especially as a utopian writer, I feel that's my personal opinion. But I feel like, And once again, the same for the very salient point that you brought up about the futuristic transphobia.
Yeah.
Which is like, okay, cool. Why is it there? What elements... Once again, I'm so sorry to be a broken record here, dear listener, but what elements of the social fabric of the story is leading to or is enabling this moment of transphobia? And people are like, oh, well, it can be a personal thing. It can be an individual thing. It can be an individual thing after the social element has failed. For me, transphobia is not a given. I don't like conceptualizing it as us. So because it's not a given, it cannot be an individual thing. And we all know that transphobia is a social ailment, in my opinion, at least. And that, once again, can be manifested in so many ways, can have different origin points, but it is a thing that is filtered through the social paradigm. And what part of this, the futuristic utopia, what about it is then giving way for this transphobia? I need to know that, because I don't know. But it isn't there, because it isn't really well worked out, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And it's just also like, the most, my last complaint about it, I'm sorry, it's just, so racism is solved, right?
Yeah.
So misogyny is solved, right?
I think so.
Okay, so once again, trans women are women. But the misogyny as we know it, yes, trans women suffer from that. And once again, trans women are women, period. I just generally sort this very specific incident not under misogyny, but under transphobia.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Why is that still there? And not racism and misogyny and all those other things. That's weird.
Yeah.
I don't...
No, for sure.
I don't like that. The Last of Us does the same thing. There's like, there's no racism, but there is still transphobia, which is like, oh, huh. How did racism... was racism solved? Again? I don't understand that. Anyway, never mind that.
But, I mean, if I want to be extremely crass...
go on.
Then a part of the point, and I... It's something that we end up noticing, and by realizing this, a lot of the pieces made sense, because I found out this afterwards, that the writer is staunchly liberal.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, some of the pieces fit, because what is effectively the kind of the effect here is that, oh, you know, there's transphobia now in, like, oh, people are of different genders or whatnot, or the binary is too strong, so there's transphobia and whatnot. And, you know, oh, if it's all unified into people being all intersex or something, then the people who identify or stray away will suffer transphobia. Where it's like,
yeah,
no, because basically what Leon just said, that it is a specific social historical phenomena that stems from something. So like, if this is the case, that the inverse... then the unify is trying to separate, then there's going to be transphobia. No, that likely wouldn't, because it is it is an out of thin air.
Yeah, it's also there's no utopia with transphobia. Oh. Those are incompatible.
Inherently. Yeah, final stop.
I will say, in her defense, she doesn't call it a utopia, I believe, anywhere in the book.
The characters probably, but again, that's fine, I think.
It's also been a while for me. Sorry, dear listener. I don't know. I don't know if they're proud of their society, but I don't know if they use the word utopia.
Maybe. But I think it's it doesn't undermine it regardless in that point.
Like, no.
There are plenty of elements which make it clear that it isn't perfect. It isn't a utopia, even if it is like utopia in some spaces other than others, but they do look at their society extremely positively. But yeah. I feel like even worse than the ecological catastrophe or something, it's a specific data point, which I double-checked right now to make sure I didn't make it up. So at one point, we are told the current world population in 3012. Do you remember, Leon?
Oh, fuck me, no, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. But I noticed, and I was like, oh my god. You know the current world population in this universe in 3012? 8 million.
Oh, okay. Yeah, right. Okay.
So, interesting. You know, I did the math. That is a tiny percentile. That's a really tiny percentile.
Well, yeah.
Given the present. So I was like, what the fuck? Like, even in...
Give or take a less than a thousandth of the current population.
Because we have 8 billion.
Yeah.
So it's reduced by, you know... anyway, sorry. It's 0.0001. Like,
pretty much. Like, it's... like it's the most extreme version of climate catastrophe, I feel. It's
yeah.
That threw me out of the box so much.
So that's exactly... Maybe my subconscious remembered that, but that's why I felt very uncomfortable with the whole definitive climate catastrophe thing that she just kind of yeeted in there for my...
Yeah.
According to my sensibilities. And we get a lot of, like, depictions on how arguments kind of work, but that argument that we, like, spend... that entire timeline on, not that entire time, but it's the lion's share of that timeline, right?
Yeah,
and it's we don't really see that brought to a close in a satisfying way, or maybe you feel different.
No, I entirely agree, because here's the thing, right? Like, it is fascinating to, like, okay, there is a point in this religiously bound utopian society that is facing legitimate and reasonable heterodoxy or heresy and the possibility of conflict. What if utopia needs to change? How can it be changed and how can it be challenged? These are incredible questions to pose. Like, I loved this aspect. But the resolution was extremely disappointing, I feel. And I think that was just kind of sad. Because, like, I knew that it's like it wasn't going to be as satisfying, but it was almost like a non-ending. Because,
but what's not to like about a girl touching the wall a bit? Oh, is that not satisfying for you, Frank? I don't get it. I'm being sarcastic, by the way.
I know.
It's just so everybody. I know you know, but I just had to specify.
I think that one of the points that kind of makes it difficult is because I mentioned, you know, the recurrence of, like, the timelines, and effectively, we're following kind of the same characters in different people in 1012, 2012, and 3012. And they are kind of at conflict in 3012, and eventually they kind of reconcile and the book ends. So,
yeah.
And, like, so what? What about the question of religion, the conflict? They effectively built two separate conflicting opposing movements, to the point where both one of them and their followers were committing, like, the most horrifying, terrifying, terrible crime in their society, which is drawing blood or trying to kill someone.
Yeah, okay.
But, you know...
The liberal showing. Sorry.
Exactly, right? Like, it is... It's not even that it solves it poorly. It refuses to solve it. It refuses to engage with the ultimate possibility of conflict. It's like... It disarms the conflict at the end. We're supposed to believe, I guess. Because, like, I don't know, maybe the society needs to change, right? It's really frustrating, I think. And the fact that the ending is not that that happens, like, they reconcile, and then we get a weird psychedelic sequence, which kind of proves a really serious point of view coming from a utopian narrative background, and I'm going to elaborate on that, because I had mentioned before, or do you want to say something before I launch off, Leon? I'm sorry.
No, don't worry.
So I mentioned before that the transcendental, spiritual, supernatural, magical beliefs were put as a question by one of these two characters in 3012. And, you know, they mostly stay on it and whatnot. But at the end, they pose, they kind of, maybe what if, like, oh, on Earth it isn't enough. Maybe we need to travel the stars to find that. And I was like, okay. But ultimately, on the one hand, that reinforces that, no, but the magical, the supernatural is still what's driving me. It's not, so the conflict is diminished even before it is non-resolved at the end. I had to say that. But more important than that is that after all that, the final sequence we get of the book is of Saint Leia in 2012 as she goes through this transcendental experience and kind of, I suppose we're led to believe, crosses over into Xibalba.
Yeah, we cannot stress enough that it is despite calling her Saint Leia, this is just a girl.
Yeah, this teenage girl from the US with Mayan heritage. And, you know, she kind of discovers and demonstrates this transcendental passage. So here's the problem for this book. This ending does on a few levels. It states that, you know, this transcendental spiritual belief is true. It exists. It happens. We may not know entirely how, but it happens. That's how it's less important, but it does. Here's where it's a problem, right? We're told that this was crucial to the society, right? Like, this was something that challenged Western traditional scientific beliefs and helped start fracturing that familiar to us present reality. Because this exists, it kind of demonstrates that any utopian alternative that this book presents is only available in a world where that exists. It entirely shuts off utopia to any reality outside of that, given the role it places on that supernatural event. This even has an analogy. This has happened in utopian fiction. In H.G. Wells' In the Days of the Comet, where utopia was possible, because utopia was made possible because the comet effected a biological social change in people, which allowed them to build a utopia. A purely external force made utopia possible by making it possible. It has always already happened. The magical element being present is what made utopia possible in this book. And if the magical is not present in our reality, again, I'm a Catholic Christian, I'm a Marxist, I'm a dialectical materialist, but without shutting anything off, if this magical undertone or reality is not a part of our given reality, then any kind of utopian prediction this book makes, plans, portrays, given the dependence it puts on it, is entirely shut off from us as any kind of political alternative. Which, you know, kind of defeats the critique point and the alternative point of utopian fiction.
Yeah. That's a good point. It's a great point, even. It's funny to me because I felt that same way, even though I didn't really put it in such eloquent terms. But it's that is one of the things that bother me about utopia as well. I would take it one step further, which is where for me, this was a difficult read because the main reason, like I've been pointing out a couple other things that structurally don't work. Mm-hmm. But there are a couple of things that conceptually just do not work for me.
Right.
Just besides the transphobia, because the transphobia is there, but it's also over very quick, which is not great. But okay, sure. But then there are a couple of conceptual things that are just like glaringly not good. For me, and this was going to be the question to you, like, how do you feel about the utopia realized through a singular religion?
I find it very strange, right? Because I do believe that as a good Marxist Catholic, I am a staunch believer in heterodoxy. I feel like heterodoxy is crucial. And given the vilification of any kind of heterodoxy in this book, it's strange. It makes me doubt the fact that other beliefs can coexist with that society, the way we see it. Because what happens at the end is a reinforcement of those religious beliefs. Just an adaptation of it, like a distinct exegesis of events, so to speak. And not a shift, not a fundamental change. And that, I think that the idea of a utopia bound with a religious set of beliefs is fascinating. Like, I think that can and should perhaps be more explored. And, you know, taking it in radical shapes, like explicitly radical shapes. But do I think it possible? Maybe, but it needs to have a really large amount of tolerance. It needs to be, if it is a single religion or a stronger religion, maybe not single, maybe I don't believe in a single religion, utopia. what does that say about me? But I do feel like if there is a utopia bound with a religious set of beliefs, it cannot be totalizing. It needs to be able to have heterodoxy. It needs to be able to have transformation, if only on account of history being a thing.
I just want to give a disclaimer. I know this is fiction. That being said, I am deeply mistrustful of the notion of a religion like being so deeply infused with the realization of these utopian ideals.
Fair.
And that's just, that once again, being really yikes, all capitals, with the 8 million people still alive. Like, where are my people? Question mark. where maybe it's just that. And I'm saying, I'm not saying that the author meant this to happen, is making a political argument here. It would have been nice if there was more of a political argument here, actually. but beside the point, she's not making a political argument here. I hope deeply, and I think she isn't. So I'm not going to accuse her of that, obviously. But it's just, I feel really uncomfortable if I were to approach this realistically, which there's magic in here, I'm not saying that this is the only way to approach it, but a more realistic approach would be a utopia that's realized not solely, but thanks through a religion, or is that deeply intertwined with that religion, would have a dubious relationship with other religions. I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm just saying, if you can buy into that, I have a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you. But that's neither here nor there. It needs to be explored more. I don't necessarily wholeheartedly agree with that. I think if you want to, you could put that idea into your book, but then guess what? That needs to be the book. The main explorational topic you introduce.
Yes.
In your book. And that's not the case. I don't know. It just makes me feel uncomfortable. Because it's like, so it is like quasi Mayan mythology. It is properly researched Mayan mythology interjected into what I recognized, and I might be wrong, but what I recognized is a sort of mostly Catholicism.
Syncretically Catholic.
Thank you. That's a great way to put it. And that just made me feel very uncomfortable, because once again, where are the Muslims? Where are the Jews? Where are the other Abrahamic religions? Where are the Buddhists? Where are the Hindus? Would have been nice if instead of the transphobia, we could have a toss away introduction of those people, maybe. Because there are Muslim Latinos. There are Jewish Latinos, actually. There are a bunch of small Jewish enclaves throughout Latin America. I have Mexican family, for instance. They married into our family. And so, even though they are Christian, it's like, still, those are my people. And it's again, Mayans aren't Mexicans. I know that, don't worry. Well, some are maybe, but it's, I know that what we understand Mexicans to be is mostly what we would call Aztec and so forth and so on. Anyway, my point being, if there are Mayans descendants, then there should also be Mexicans. That's all I'm saying. But long story short, why? I could get more into it maybe if, once again, and I'm so sorry to sound like a broken record here for the second time, if the utopian ideals in this utopian society was worked out for the better.
Yeah.
And this is where, for the so many years time, we see things fall apart because that wasn't done properly.
Yeah, exactly.
Although I deeply respect the ideals that are fundamental to this utopia.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, for sure. I'm sorry for interrupting. No, I think you're completely right. And I think it's one of the issues that we've mostly been talking about, and because it was the most interesting bit of the book to us, which is effectively a third of the book, which is only the future. Because the others, for plot reasons, I suppose, they're okay. They're interesting to follow at times, but there's not that much there. Like, we're following a decadent royal family, which, okay, or following a teenage girl in a journey of discovering her roots and self-discovery, and okay. And then, yeah. then there's the utopian aspect of the book. And obviously one of these is not like the others, and that's the one we spent the most time on. But the interplay is all right. It's interesting. It mostly works, but it undermines what is most novel about this book, which is its utopian representation, creation, depiction. But again, the more we look at it, the more gaps we find, and really, really serious gaps. Like, to me, just that figure of 8 million screams detail. Like, I need some more on this. I need to know how like the level of catastrophe prolongedly necessarily led to this low number, and like this level of recovery 1,000 years later, right? Like, I need some more info on that. And just like, I want to like this book, I liked it a lot when I read it, but there are gaps, there are issues involved, and I wanted to realize, or to at least try and realize, some of the conflicts involved, right? Like, I didn't expect an answer to, like, how do you deal with conflict in utopia? How do you deal with strong, fundamental, essential, dramatic change in utopia? I didn't expect a full answer to that, because there is no such thing. But, you know, an attempt, an investment upon it, and not just... It almost feels like the utopia wasn't the focus of the story. And the focus of the story were the twins, their relationship throughout 1012, 2012, 3012. And that's okay, but it undermines everything else from a clear plot point of view, right? Like, oh, what about this? What about this? What about this? At the end of the day, that is not the most important story, because the book spends a lot more time on the relationship between these two people, or souls, or spirits, or whatever you want to call it, throughout these three points in time. They're getting close, getting further, getting close, getting further, the most in 3012, and then getting closest again at the end of that. And...
yeah.
Okay. Okay, that's... I don't mind that, but I... so much was lost with the use of that utopia in almost for a third of that book. For it only being a third. If only it was more. Right, if only the book was actually about that. Anyway, I for the record, I do not regret reading it. I feel like it was fascinating. I thought it was really interesting to read, and definitely worth reading, and interesting to see further engagements with like Marge Percy's idea and whatnot. But ultimately, it didn't push as far as Kim Stanley Robinson does and did, as Le Guin did, as Marge Percy did. We need to look elsewhere to continue pushing utopia, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah, I... well said. I do think there is a throwaway line, but I am appreciative of it, which is that I was afraid that she was going to, like, glorify Mayan Empire stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, and then... there's this very quick throwaway line there about, yeah, and the other kingdoms which were submitted to us by conquest, blah, 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 blah. And she goes on. And I was like, okay, well, we should have spent a bit more time about that, because we tend to glorify, like, you know, because just because, like, a part of the world is colonized, it doesn't mean that those were, like, perfect people up to that point.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, a totally normal thing to be able to admit, and nobody needs them to be perfect people. Because nobody in the world, surprise, surprise, was. And, like, you can admire these things about the Aztec Empire, about, like, you know, their city building, but they were also brutal conquerors.
Yeah.
You can admire the Mayans for figuring out the stars, but they were also brutal conquerors. And you can admire the Inca, well, you're getting the idea. And it's, so, I don't know, I do appreciate, even though it was very bare minimum, she didn't shy away from that, but once again,
Could have spent some more time on that. That's just a side note that I have.
Yeah, no.
Apropos of nothing, I'm sorry.
No, for sure. And, you know, you're right, because we spend a lot of time with royalty.
Yeah. The individualism of her liberalism shines through very strongly in this book.
Yes, yes. At the end of the day, it's not really about, you know, the people they killed, the things they did. It's more like, no, we need to reconcile with one another at the end. And it's like, really? Is that it? That's all you need to atone for if you need to atone for something?
Yeah, it would have also been great if there were, like, other enclaves. And this was just a very specific Latin American one.
Yeah, yeah.
Of utopians. But we can't because we only have 8 million people, which is suspicious. So, it's once again, all these details cancel each other out in the worst way. No, it's okay. Not in the worst way. That's a bit strong, my bad. But in a way that definitely doesn't work, in my opinion.
A way that really doesn't hold that up well to scrutiny.
Yeah.
To give us some kind of, okay, we get it. It's like, we have been analyzing a third of a book as if it was the whole book. But the book wants us to take it seriously. So we have.
Well, yeah.
And we found it lacking, unfortunately.
I will say, there's a reason why we admire utopian fiction. That's because writing it, it takes a tremendous amount of skill.
Yes.
It is a... I don't believe in the conceptualization of high art or whatever, but if I did, utopian writing would be one of them. So, you know, it's that's just a bit like, I don't know. I feel like because of that, as I often talk about, knowing, be aware of the tradition you're partaking in.
Yeah.
And utopian writing is, you know, there's a reason why Ursula Le Guin is on such a pedestal. It's well deserved. And there's a reason why, you know, the Book of Utopia, Thomas More, is still talked about today. Like, you know, utopian writing is a very specific and a steep learning curve type skill of writing, I think, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Because you need to know about so many different things. You need to, once again, you need to be aware of the individual, the psychological, and the social. But also of social science, of psychological realities, of, like, history, of economics, of, you know, there's all these things that tie into it. And so if you try your hand at it, sadly, we're going to have to be critical about every single facet, even though it might feel like, you know, unfair. It's sadly required for any serious analysis of utopianism.
Yeah, I think, like, unfortunately, the utopian society was thought of as a third of the book, or as a third aspect of the book and not the whole book, right? Like, it didn't all culminate for it, like, for us, the third part trumps, or the third point in time trumps the other two. But in terms of writing, yeah, that doesn't feel that way. They're relatively balanced, which is a choice, but it undermines the approach we find interesting, which is, you know, the novel one.
I wonder then, when we do our analysis, what is there in the other parts, the other two-thirds, to be analyzed as rigorously as that one third that we have been talking about.
Yeah.
Because they're supposed to all come together and have a strong cohesion. And there is a cohesion.
Yeah.
But not a strong one. And you know, like, we have talked about it a little bit, but there's sadly just, there are some moments maybe worth talking about, but there isn't enough meat on the bone, so to speak, sorry for the terrible metaphor, to really analyze in the other two thirds of the book.
Yeah.
In the other timelines, I would say.
Yeah.
Because they are deeply individual, and because of their individualism, there isn't a broader thing to interact with, other than I can condemn the racism that Leah faces by her stepdad, for instance.
Yeah.
But once again, I've just said that, okay, done. There's sadly not much more to say about that than that. And then about the gods, the royals, which is interesting at least, because once again, there aren't many big books that write about that.
Yeah.
And once again, all the endless amount of European folklore, mythology, history that we fictionalize is also, you know, 90% of that is just like stuff. So this is allowed to, you know, be there as well. But at the same time, I'm like, okay, well, I wish we had done more with that.
Yeah.
royals are, well, they engage with a certain thing that I'm deeply uncomfortable reading about, but it's not here or there. It's, but then again, I could get into that, and then I would have just said that. And the only thing that we can more broadly contextually get into is this one third of the book. So sorry, I just wanted to defend that choice a little bit more. I'm sorry.
No, for sure. And I do stand behind it. Otherwise, you know, we wouldn't have done the episode the way we did. But it is to give a slight caveat that, we are working on a third, but we have strong reasons to, and it is... I don't know, it's a part that I think deserves scrutiny for what it's trying to do. And, you know, it's, as you always put it, and I think you're right, we'd rather you shoot for the moon and only come halfway than you aim at the moon and then intentionally fire a blank.
Yeah.
This was the actual star.
This was the actual episode on the actual star, actually.
Indeed it was.
Thank you, Nate.
do not feel discouraged, please.
Yeah, please don't anybody. Please recommend us. It meant just apropos of everything. It truly meant the world to me that someone would reach out to us and suggest anything. I deeply appreciate that. Yeah, and I will say I'm very happy that happened for that reason, but also for the reason that this book. Which is a compliment to Nate, not to the writer. But this book made me understand what I want out of Utopia books a lot more than I did before reading this book.
Yeah.
It's like looking at a negative is as helpful sometimes as looking at a positive.
Yeah, I think. For sure.
So yeah, thank you so much, Nate, once again.
Yeah, no, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And thank you so much, everyone, for sticking with us, for listening to another episode of The Left Page. If you'd like to check us out, some of the other stuff we've been doing, do check out TRB Media. We have been posting some other texts up on Patreon on media, some theories or thinking about media or how we approach media. So please do check those out on patreon.com/leftpage. And do be on the lookout because some exclusive Patreon content is going to be started coming up soon as we get creative and do some... new and fun stuff and talk about good and bad stuff. So if you're interested on that, do consider checking us out on Patreon, even just following us. You'll see when stuff goes up and you get access to early episodes, usually whenever we're finished editing it. And yeah, thank you so much for listening. Thank you all our Patreon supporters. Thanks again, Nate, for the great suggestion. And yeah, thank you so much, everyone.
Take care.
Bye-bye.